The Church of God, the Eternal, presents Because God Said So, the first message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Why Keep the Feast? Given on opening night of the Feast of Tabernacles in Yahats, Oregon, October 16th, 2024.
Here we are again, gathered together on the opening night of this seven-day feast. What a blessing God's Feast of Tabernacles is every year. We plan for it, we prepare for it, we expend a lot of time and energy and money, and especially our hopes and our dreams for all that this feast represents in the plan of God and our role in it. And so it is a pleasure to address all of you again in 2024, with our prayers that you are being blessed in every place around the globe where you are gathered together in one of those designated places in order to meet God, in order to commune with Him, in order to show respect and honor to Him in the keeping of this seven-day feast plus the last great day, day eight. As you know, or many of you will know, in the old days of our parent church, Mr. Herbert Armstrong would ask the question, why are we here? And so very often at the fall feast, he did that as a way to segue into an explanation for some of the fundamentals concerning the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, at this year's feast, I'm going to do something similar. I'm going to say the why are we here is a cousin to the topic, the theme that I'm going to provide for you this feast. Because we're going to analyze a lot of the basics to confirm why we do the things that we do, and then, you know, why do we think the way that we think? So we presume a lot of things, especially when we go through the motions because we've done it year after year. But I want to encourage you to stop and to think, what is the root reason in your thinking and your behavior for everything that you choose to do, and especially related to keeping this Feast of Tabernacles? If someone were to ask you, why do you keep or go to that religious retreat every year in the autumn, what would you answer? Well, I would expect that the majority of you, if we did a survey, I'll bet you the number one reason that people in God's church would say that they're keeping the feast is because God commanded it. And you would be absolutely correct. And so tonight, to open this feast, we're actually going to focus upon that first predominant reason for the reason that we're keeping the feast. Because God said so. Now, throughout this feast, I'm going to give you a lot of other reasons to keep the feast. But it seems very appropriately that we start with the automatic one that comes to the minds of most. So let's start in Leviticus 23, which is the chapter where all of the feasts of God are listed and specified. We'll start in verse 1 of Leviticus 23, and here we read, "The Eternal spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them concerning the feasts of the Eternal." Now this phrase is going to be repeated a lot, and I'm going to emphasize it every time. Whose feasts are these? Were they the feasts of Moses? Were they the feasts of anyone else? They are the property of God. He calls them his feasts. So to Moses was revealed all that Moses wrote down here, but they are the feasts of God. They are his property. They are his possession. And that becomes significant. "The Eternal spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and saying to them concerning the feasts of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, even these are my feasts, says God." But in case you would think that, well, if they're God's feast, then maybe he's the only one that keeps them. But as we just read, they are his property, and yet he commands that now they be kept by human beings. And it is through convocation, which is a gathering together in designated places, again, because it's about meeting God. It's about coming into His presence. And so they are His, but then you and I, if we're going to show respect for this God, are going to come into His very presence and commune with Him at those specific times. Continuing now in verse 3, here's the first feast in the long list throughout this entire chapter. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work therein. It is the Sabbath of the Eternal in all your dwellings. So it's the weekly Sabbath is the first in the list of God's feasts. Did you know that the weekly Sabbath is a feast day? It is. As we're going to see, there's two categories. There's the weekly Sabbath, and then there are all the annual Sabbaths. But in every case, they are all called feasts. So now, after the weekly Sabbath, we see those feasts that are annual rather than weekly, meaning they come one time a year rather than once every 7 days. Verse 4, these, God said, are the feast of the Eternal, even holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in their seasons, which is significant. What is important about this phrase, in their seasons? Because this is very distinct from the feast that we keep weekly on Saturday. The weekly Sabbath is kept all year around, every 7 days. But now is going to be a long list of days which are kept only one time a year, which is why we call them annual feasts. These seasons then mark time periods in every year when each of these holy day feasts, these annual holy days, must fall. And it harkens back to the construct of the calendar, God's calendar, the Hebrew calendar, which helps define to make sure those holy days always fall in the proper season, not just in the correct month, but the month must also then hold holy days which show up in the proper season, which is part of the complexity of the Hebrew calendar according to God's wise inspiration. But let's go back to Genesis 1 at the very beginning of the creation, where God reveals the significance of key parts of His creation as it relates to Sabbaths and holy days. Genesis 1 verse 14, God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them," these lights up in the sky, "let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years." So they have a multitude of purposes, but one of them is for seasons. And seasons, the astronomical season, is defined in relationship to the movement of the earth around the sun one time every solar year. And so the seasons, there are four seasons which correlate to the position of the earth at different times, either in winter, spring, summer, or fall. So just continuing on to get the whole context, verse 15, "And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And so it was. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also, and God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day." So you see emphasized here the issue of day and night, which has to do with the earth's rotation actually on its axis, which is what allows the earth to experience approximately 12 hours of daylight and then 12 hours of darkness, depending on where you are in the globe. But yet we already saw the definition in verse 14 includes the fact that it's not just days and nights, it's also seasons and years. which has to do then with the Earth's movement around the sun and its position at different times or snapshots, if you will, in its progression annually. Psalm 104, verse 19, here we read, "He appointed the moon for seasons." Isn't that an interesting statement? So we already saw in Genesis that the sun and the moon, those two great lights, along with the stars, all work together for a purpose, and one of them has to do with, besides days, the seasons. And here we see specifically, he appointed the moon for seasons. Did you know that? And what does the moon have to do with seasons? If, as I already just said, the seasons have to do with the earth going around the sun. So now why does God, did I just contradict God? Because he said he appointed the moon for seasons. The sun knoweth his going down. No, it just means the moon is also involved in it. How so? The movement of the moon around the earth, approximately every 29 and a half days, also is involved in the establishment of the legal seasons in God's calendar. Because God's calendar is lunisolar, which means it must take into account both the movement of the moon as well as the movement of the earth around the sun. It includes both. It never excludes one or the other, like other worldly calendars do that you can find around the globe. The Egyptian calendar, for instance, is a solar calendar. It basically ignores the movement of the moon around the earth and looks only at the movement of the earth around the sun. That's why it's called a solar calendar. The Muslim calendar is opposite. It ignores the movement of the earth around the sun and looks only at the movement of the moon. So it's a lunar calendar. The true calendar of God involves harmonizing both the lunar month as well as the solar year. And in order to do that, because they don't mix up or they don't marry up easily, then there must be calculations and rules that are to determine then when New Year's Day falls every year. And why? And what does this have to do with our topic about why we keep the feast? Because this whole issue about months and about years and about seasons during the year is all for what purpose? Holy days. The reason it's important is because God designated these revealed feasts that we started to look at in Leviticus 23, and he said, "These are commands for you to come into my presence and to worship and to keep these feasts every year." Besides the weekly Sabbath every week. And there's no way that you and I can fulfill that command to keep the feast if we don't know when the feast falls. So I'm not turning this into a sermon about the calendar. But I want you to see this in context, that the calendar is absolutely critical or you don't know when to appear. God has a command performance to appear in his midst and to worship him and to celebrate with him and to commune with him. You can't do that if you show up on the wrong day. So a calendar is absolutely required. And the calendar of God, which he made sure to reveal, not by the wisdom of human beings and their own ideologies and their ideas and their theories, the calendar God revealed to his church confirms how to know when those feasts fall. And so he appointed the moon as a part of knowing the season, because the holy days got to fall in the right season as well as in the correct month. Jeremiah 31, verse 35. Jeremiah 31, verse 35, "Thus saith the Eternal, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and the stars for light by night." I didn't do a word study on this, but the ordinances implies laws and a regimen now that is set in motion by God to do something predictably. which is exactly what happens. The ordinances of the moon and of the stars for a light by night, which divides the sea when the waves thereof roar. Did you ever realize here God actually reveals that the movement of the moon around the earth every month affects the ocean? Yeah, we call that the tides. And so the tidal flow approximately twice every day, which man can absolutely predict in every area. And they do, they have tide tables. And so it is so predictable, knowing the influence of the gravitational relationship between the moon and the earth and the sun, by the way, at all times during a given month, as the moon is traveling in its orbit around the earth, and the earth's relationship to the sun and the moon to the sun, and man is able to calculate all this out and tell you exactly what the tide level is going to be at any given time, day or night, at any given day during the year. That's how much of an ordinance, a law, a predictable event that it is. But it's not accidental at all. God is the one who has declared it. Verse 36, if those ordinances depart from before me, God said, saith the Eternal, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. Isn't that interesting? In other words, God has put his own reputation at stake, if you will, by the orderly movement of the sun, the moon, the stars, and the earth in the midst of the heavens, and said this is a confirmation, likewise, of God's work with a called people, which has to do with offering salvation to the entire human family. Now, total separate tangent, but take into account then what we know concerning events leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ, and we talked about more of those on the Feast of Trumpets, but especially Revelation 6, we're not turning there, concerning that sixth seal, which is going to be open in succession, and the upheaval that's going to take place in the heavens, and the relationship of the earth and the moon to the sun and to every other astral body. So is that, because God says that's going to happen, is that a confirmation then that Israel is going to cease to have the promise of salvation? No. It's still going to be according to God's dictate, but it's going to be totally different than it is now, and it is going to scare human beings nearly to death. Because the orderliness that they take for granted in the heavens, which makes them feel confident about who they are and what they're doing, is totally going to be moved out of place by God for reason. And yet God is still in control of it at all times. Back to Leviticus 23, because we're still trying to answer the question, why keep the feast? And of course, our answer tonight is because God said so. The only thing I'm trying to do here tonight is to give you a repeat of the foundational material that has to do with the fact that these Sabbaths, weekly and annual, are created by God, commanded by God, ordained by God, set in motion by God. And it's all about Sabbaths and holy days. Back to Leviticus 23, and now in verse 33 is the command specifically for the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day. And the Eternal spake unto Moses, saying, verse 34, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days unto the Eternal. So here is a command to keep the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days, starting on the 15th day of the seventh month. How are you and I ever going to do that if we don't even know when the seventh month is during the year, let alone track the days to know when is day 15 of month 7? Got to have a calendar, don't you? Verse 35, on the first day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. And that's the day that we're in right now, which started at sunset just a little while ago. So you are now currently in the 15th day of the seventh month on God's calendar. If you have confidence in that, if you're going by the calendar God revealed and gave to His church, you should have confidence in that. You should have confidence to know that you truly are here on the right evening after sunset, which is the day now that God has hallowed as one of His high annual Sabbaths. And by following His instructions to convoke in a place where He has placed His name, and that's a whole authority thing, which is not my purpose, but is real, then you can have confidence, and you should have confidence now, that you are showing honor and respect for that holy Creator God. On the first day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. Then verse 36, 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Eternal. On the eighth day shall be a holy convocation unto you. And you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Eternal as a solemn assembly, and you shall do no servile work therein. So here we find out it's not just a 7-day feast, that's the one called Tabernacles, but then it's followed immediately by another, an eighth day, which is a holy day. And we call it the last great day. So this is different than the spring feast of unleavened bread. And you read that earlier in this chapter. I'm not going to do that for time's sake. But there you find it's a 7-day feast, and the first day is a high day, and the seventh day is a high day. First and last day of unleavened bread are both holy days. Very different from this one. In this case, the first high day is a holy day, but not the seventh. The seventh day, the Feast of Tabernacles, is not a holy day, but the day that follows it is. And so there's a reason for that, because all of these have a story that go with them to explain to us the plan that God is unfolding in His relationship with the human family to offer salvation. And so we'll cover the meaning of the last great day when we get to it. Verse 37, God says, these are the feasts of the Eternal. Because after going through the command for every single one of them and tell you when they are, and then after all of that is done, verse 37 says, these are the feasts of the Eternal, repeating from what we read at the beginning of the chapter, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations. They're God's feasts, but He says, you're going to proclaim them and keep them. To offer an offering made by fire unto the Eternal, a burnt offering and a meat offering, a sacrifice, a drink offering, and everything upon this day, beside the Sabbaths of the Eternal, which we just listed, and besides your gifts, and besides all your vow, and besides your freewill offerings, which you give to the Eternal, also in the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast unto the Eternal 7 days. On the first day shall be a Sabbath, and on the eighth day shall be a Sabbath. So a repeat of the command we just read from verse 33 to 36. Verse 40, and you shall take you on the first day the boughs of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of thick trees, willows of the brook. You shall rejoice before the Eternal your God 7 days, and you shall keep it a feast unto the Eternal 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. I am not getting into a detailed explanation of how to keep the feast appropriately, and you've got, you know, whether you've got people practicing Judaism, whether they're physical Jews or not, or others who have attached themselves. And so they literally think that they are going to keep this command by making a booth made out of tree branches. And they're going to sit in their tree branch booth every day during the 7-day feast, and now they're fulfilling the command. These are physical aspects, including burnt offerings. I beg to ask the question, if you're not offering animal sacrifices, why are you also doing tree branches? We were taught the spiritual fulfillment and the obligation of the New Testament church in these things. Now, you can have your own opinion, and I can make up my own, and we could just create our own religions if we want to. But I'm here to tell you why we're keeping it the way we do. And anybody who has a different idea, you can keep it on any day you decide you want to, and you can keep it in any manner you decide you think you want to honor God. We are here to follow what we were taught, which is called the faith once delivered, that which Jesus Christ revealed to his church through a chosen servant who clarified all of these things. Like it or not, whether you call us fools or not, that's what we're going to do. Whatever you do, you better do it out according to your conscience, and then you better be willing to do it until your death. Understanding that it is a choice which has everything to do with whether God will accept your offering or not. God did not accept the offering of Cain, even though he was making an offering, because he wasn't following God's instructions. He accepted Abel's offering, but not Cain's. What a lesson for all of us. So I'm not getting into all that litany of the explanations. I'm just trying to keep it hitting the high spots now as a confirmation of the fact that God did command it. And he made it possible for people of faith to literally keep the commands concerning the weekly Sabbath and the annual Sabbaths, and to do it in confidence, so that you know that you're coming before him in a place where he has designated to make your offering, what you're doing by your very presence and by singing the hymns, which you did to start this service, the special music that is a part of those services, and the prayers, the opening and the closing prayer, where we acknowledge the presence of God and we ask for his inspiration on the entire event. We're not just going through some religious ceremony out of habit. We believe these things are true, that God did command it. And again, Jesus Christ said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." We're trying to show honor to that Creator God. And the keeping of this Feast of Tabernacles now is an important element of it. Verse 41, "You shall keep it a feast unto the eternal 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations." And this is one of those that literally means it doesn't end. Every single year, all the way. And as we're going to find out, not just up until the second coming of Jesus Christ, but all the way through the millennium and the white throne judgment period, this feast is going to be kept. "You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall dwell in booths 7 days." Why? Is this just a physical command? It means you must pick yourself up and go to the place where God has established his Feast of Tabernacles, and you must meet there for all 7 days, plus the last great day, the eighth day. Unlike the command for the spring feast of unleavened bread, where you don't have the command for temporary dwellings. And as we were taught, and it's a part of our doctrine, there is a distinction then for keeping the spring feast versus the fall feast in this issue about literally needing to pack up and go whatever distance is required in order to make it to the nearest designated place to make your offerings before God, and to do it for all 7 consecutive days plus the last great day. It's absolutely unique to this particular feast compared to any other annual feast. Verse 43, "That your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the eternal your God." Verse 44, "And Moses declared unto the children of Israel the feasts of the eternal." He is very possessive about these feasts. And yet, as I've already showed you, he commands you and I to observe them and to keep them. So yes, it's absolutely understandable that your number one reason that would come to your mind when asked the question, why do you go to that religious retreat every year. In the autumn, if you live in the northern hemisphere, it's the opposite season if you're in the southern hemisphere. Why do you do that every year? Because God said so. The Sabbaths, the annual Sabbaths, the weekly and the annual Sabbaths, the holy days, were never done away. It is not just a Jewish thing, which is what the majority of so-called Christians believe in this world. Oh, well, many of them say, well, if you are physically a Jew, then yeah, you're required to keep them, but we're Gentiles, which means we don't have to keep them. Not so. The weekly Sabbath became part of the law of Moses. We're going to read that in Exodus 20, verse 8 momentarily. But to give you this chain of thought for reference, the weekly Sabbath became part of what is called the law of Moses, and it confuses a lot of people because they think the law of Moses was temporary and was done away. No, there were different aspects of everything that God calls the law of Moses. Since the Sabbath, however, preceded the law of Moses, didn't it? When did the weekly Sabbath come into existence? We're going to read it all the way at the beginning of creation. And yet the Sabbath is called also part of the law of Moses. What do we conclude from that? The law of Moses then also preceded the old covenant with Israel on Mount Sinai. All too many simplistically want to just say, oh, the law of Moses was that which God commanded Moses, animal sacrifices and holy days, Sabbaths and holy days, all of that was for the Jews. No. The holy days began to be commanded before Israel ever made it to Mount Sinai. And the weekly Sabbath went all the way back to the beginning of creation, or the recreation. And the holy days were a part of it. Now, yes, the annual holy days unfolded after creation. They did not come into existence in Genesis in the Garden of Eden like the weekly Sabbath did. But God made sure through the writings of Moses to declare the annual holy days and then to command them, as we've already said, for every generation until the very end of the plan with man. So let's turn to Exodus 20, where we find the Ten Commandments, and specifically verses 8 through 11. Exodus 20, beginning in verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy maidservant, nor thy manservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. So the command here is not only that you keep the Sabbath, but that you enforce a respect for the Sabbath in the domain that you uniquely control and have charge of. Which means if you have an apartment or a home or an estate, and you are the sole controller of that, owner, leasor, whatever, or leasee, I should say, then on that property, you have an obligation to make sure the Sabbath is respected. You can't make other people truly keep the Sabbath, but you can keep them from violating physically the Sabbath. Now, if you have an unconverted mate, you don't have unique control even over the place that you live. And that has to be taken in consideration. But what you have personally control over, this command says you have an obligation to make sure the Sabbath is respected. Verse 11, for in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Isn't it interesting? By the command that was revealed to Israel here through Moses, God hearkens back to the true origin of the Sabbath day, which went all the way back to the recreation. Wherefore the Eternal blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. When? At the beginning. When did that seventh day of the week first began to be a holy day from the first one. Day seven, when God himself rested from his labors, that's when the day became holy. And other holy days, including the Passover, Feast of Unleavened Bread, were instituted prior to the sacrificial system, by the way, at Mount Sinai. It was the sacrificial system that was added later, not to be confused with the laws or the commands of God. It was added later, and it was only temporary, because the sacrificial system then was pointing toward a time when the sins of man could be forgiven. That was going to be done through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But that is very distinct. The entire sacrificial system basically tells you then when a sin takes place, what do you have to do to get rid of the penalty for sin? If you can just simply in your mind understand the difference between God's rules of right and wrong versus a set of rules for what happens if somebody breaks a law, it'll make it so much easier. So it was only after Israel sinned, after they entered into a covenant relationship with God, and God says, I take you as my wife, which is what he did, and Jeremiah 3 confirms it, and Israel took God as her husband. And that was a contract, a marriage covenant that was sealed by the sprinkling of blood. They each made promises to each other. But that was not the institution of God's laws for right and wrong. God's rules for right and wrong went all the way back to the beginning. This was just a marriage covenant, a special pact that God made, which told these Israelites, if you will respect my pre-existing laws, then I will give you special blessings. Now, they didn't do it, because in quick order, they turned around and built a golden calf. Then, thereafter, through Moses, God instituted a sacrificial system to remind them of sin. What is sin? Transgression of the law. And what happens when you break a law? Somebody has to pay. And God also says, just summarizing, the wages of sin is death. The soul that sins, it shall die. How do you buy your way out of a mistake that you made if you violated God's law? You can't just do good works in the future to pay for the bad thing that you did. The only thing that you can use to pay for your debt is your life. Animal sacrifices were a temporary way for God to make the point to these people that death and the shedding of blood is required when sin takes place. But that was all temporary to point to the one sacrificial lamb and his shed blood, which was going to pay for the sins of the whole world, and that would be Jesus Christ. So once Christ actually did it, when he came and he became and qualified to be our high priest by his death and his resurrection, his shed blood, then there was no need for a substitute of animal sacrifices, which is exactly what the book of Hebrews confirms. So that part was changed. A sacrificial system wasn't totally expunged. It was just translated from animal sacrifices as a symbol to Jesus Christ, who was the literal fulfillment of it for the benefit of the entire human race. But that's totally separate from God's rules of right and wrong. How to show love to God, how to show love to fellow man. Those rules went all the way back from the beginning, including the weekly Sabbath. Now, the annual Sabbaths were added in later generations leading up to, which is why, you know, you've got these groups Church of God, Seventh Day, or whatever these different ones, who will keep the weekly Sabbath, but they say the annual Sabbaths were part of the temporary thing that was done away. Then why are they all listed in Leviticus 23? When God says, these are my feasts, all of them, weekly and annual, they cannot be severed. And anybody who says that the annual Sabbaths are done away is saying that the plan of God for the salvation of mankind was done away. Oh, no, it is not. Not if you have any hope of the future. Jeremiah 7, verse 22. God says, for I spake not unto your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out from the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. I wonder how many people know that. Go back and read it in Exodus. He never said anything to them about a sacrificial system until after they had already entered into a marriage covenant on Mount Sinai. When they first came out of Egypt, wasn't an issue. I spake not unto your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. But this thing commanded I them. Here's what God commanded when they came out of Egypt, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk you in all the ways that I have commanded you, and it shall be well with you. What's he saying? The sacrificial system was separate and distinct and had to do with what happens once you break a law. But the commands of God are the rules that are important that tell you how to live. And only if you violate one of those does a penalty thing have to come into play one way or another. Two separate distinctions. The laws for living and the rules God added to say what happens to someone who violates the rules for living. You got to understand the difference. And as I've already stated for you, the holy days, the annual holy days stand or fall with the weekly Sabbath, which is why they're all in Leviticus 23. Confirmation from the New Testament, the Apostle Paul set an example in keeping the holy days. Notice Acts 18, verses 19 through 21. Acts 18, beginning in verse 19, he came to Ephesus and left them there, but he himself entered into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they desired him to tarry longer time with them, he consented not, verse 21, but bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that cometh in Jerusalem. He's not talking about a weekly Sabbath. He's talking about an annual feast. But I will return again unto you if God will. And he sailed from Ephesus. So people twist themselves into knots trying to explain why Paul said this. First, they say, well, he was a Jew. He was a physical Jew. So he was still keeping things that were not required of the Gentile converts. No. The Apostle Paul was the apostle sent to raise up those churches in Asia Minor, in the Gentile world. And he was not going to confuse them by teaching them the requirements for things that were not required by God, which is why you had these debates that ultimately had to be resolved. And they were. Now, another explanation, they try and say, well, Acts 18, verse 21 should not be there. They say that's not a legitimate text. And so there's a lot of people, because they don't want, they'll say, well, the Sabbath and the holy days were done away because you can't find them being kept in the New Testament, Acts 18, 21. And so what do they say? Oh, well, then they dispute over whether that is an added perverse text, which is not really a part of the inspired book or not. That goes back to an old argument, and this is all documented in our parent church's history. Certain modern translations do omit this text based upon corrupt manuscripts of Rome from the Vatican and Alexandria, Egypt. But you know when those texts came out? The 4th century AD. 4th century AD. All of a sudden, you had certain translations of the New Testament scripture that eliminated verse 21. How authoritative do you think that is? Do you think human beings have a tendency to want to rewrite history? Do you see it happening all around you in the world today? What's interesting is that with modern technology, what people say and what they do and what's recorded in audio and video has a long life. And so politicians hate it when they've changed their position and they want to claim they never said something or did something, and then people can come up with the evidence of it. But it doesn't stop human beings trying to expunge the history. They try it. And in some cases, they're successful. But they never expunge the truth of God. So God protected miraculously and brought down to us His holy scripture so that the New Testament church would have the real truth of God that is required in order for us to know how to worship Him. And this account of the Apostle Paul making provision to go so that he could be in Jerusalem for an annual holy day after now he is teaching this to the Gentiles is a further proof that the holy days were not done away. 1 Corinthians 5 verse 7 is another one. They definitely can't get rid of this one. 1 Corinthians 5, beginning verse 7, "Purge out therefore the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened." Of course, we're talking about the spring here. "For even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us." Verse 8, "Therefore let us keep the feast." Who? The church in Corinth, who Paul was writing to. Primarily made up of non-physical Israelites, and yet he's telling them to keep the feast. What feast? The seven-day feast of unleavened bread. How confusing if the annual holy days are done away, then why is Paul confusing the church by telling them to keep unleavened bread? Not only confirming it needs to be kept, but telling them in mind how to keep the Passover and unleavened bread, which is what this whole passage is about. "Not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." So, were the annual holy days, including Passover — Passover is not a holy day, it's a solemn observance — was Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Pentecost, the Day of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, the seven-day Feast of Tabernacles, and the last great day, were they done away? Or are they still obligations of true Christians to show proper respect and honor for the living God? Yes, they are. The ministry of the New Testament church, likewise, just for an additional evidence, is required to give meat in due season. Let's notice it in Matthew 24, verse 44 through 46. Meat in due season. What is that phrase even about? Well, we already saw a description of what a season is, right? And the seasons, the days and the years and the months, the seasons, are all about providing a framework in order for you to know when those holy special occasions occur so that you can fulfill the will of God. And the New Testament church, here we read in verse 44 of Matthew 24, "Therefore be you also ready," Christ said, "for in such an hour as you think not the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and a wise servant?" Now here's a prophecy for the time leading up to his second coming, in the institution of his thousand-year millennial reign, which is what this Feast of Tabernacles pictures. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household?" There's somebody given authority in relationship to an operation of God all the way from the first century AD until the time of Christ's second coming. "Whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household." What kind of rulership? With what kind of authority? "To give them meat in due season." What are these ones with authority supposed to be doing during this time? preaching the truth of Jesus Christ in the proper season. Why does season have anything to do with it unless the holy days are still at play? Otherwise, it would be just, well, the holy day, you know, Sabbath and holy days done away. Christ kept them so we don't have to. You as a good Christian, you just have to try to be a good person, but you have no obligation to keep the law. Then what's this thing about preaching in season? Because the holy days weren't done away. That's why. The annual holidays, as well as the weekly Sabbath, were still absolutely in force, would be in force, would not be abrogated. And a faithful ministry is still going to be upholding them and speaking in the name of Jesus Christ to hold holy convocations on those weekly Sabbaths and annual high days, and then teaching on those annual high days a reminder of the meaning of each one in the overall plan of God. A reminder every single year about what it is we're doing and why. We're not just doing it for the sake of, you know, historical habit. Because it's telling you, it's rehearsing the plan of how God is offering salvation to the human race. And so the Feast of Tabernacles is a key part. Don't want to step on material for the next several days. There's a lot of other reasons to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. But tonight we're focusing just on the fact that God said so. To give them meat in due season. This is a prophecy. Someone is still going to be doing this, even in the harrowing days leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ, when the sins of the world have come to the full and the evils of mankind are without comparison in human history, even as Christ said it would be like in the days of Noah and in Sodom and Gomorrah. And yet someone is still going to be proclaiming the original revealed truth in their season. That means they're still going to be using God's holy calendar, which tells them when the seasons are, the beginning of the year, the beginning of every month during the year, so that they can confirm the right dates for annual holy days. And then on those holy days, in their proper season, they're going to be proclaiming a reminder of the truth about God's plan. Verse 46, blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. So for those who say, well, I would, you know, if there was a faithful ministry still left somewhere today, I, you know, would certainly go to their Feast of Tabernacles. But I don't believe any of these ministers out here are following God. So I'm just going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles at home. No, you're not. Because here is one of a number of texts where Christ prophetically confirmed there would be faithful servants, even at his second coming, that are proclaiming it with his authority, because he did give them rulership over his household. We're talking about the household of faith, otherwise known as the church. And there would be leaders being inspired by Jesus Christ to confirm the truth and to provide an appointment for weekly Sabbaths and annual holy days so that the faithful people of God could be in the right place to worship God in spirit and in truth. And this is going to go on all the some way, somehow, all the way into the second coming of Jesus Christ. And again, we don't claim that we're the only one, but we do believe we are a part of it. We don't need to claim we're the only ones doing it. There may be ones we have no idea are out there somewhere other parts of the globe, legitimately with God's authority doing it. But if so, they're going to be keeping the very same doctrine that we're proclaiming in this little group, because there's only one truth. And we're not proclaiming that which came out of our own thinking. We've got a history of teaching all the way back over 90 years from the early 20th century for the things that we're still doing today. And if we are a part of that faithful remnant that Jesus Christ also prophesied, then we will be holding on and providing a haven for those who want to show the proper respect for God and to receive his blessing in so doing. somebody is still going to be doing it all the way to the end. Furthermore, so that's proof Sabbath and the holy days have not been done away. They were still being extant in the first century church. And they're also prophesied to be kept after Jesus Christ returns and establishes the millennium, which this feast pictures. Notice Zechariah 14 in closing. Zechariah 14 and verse 16, the entire world one day is going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, like you're doing right now. Zechariah 14, beginning in verse 16, it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem, so the time frame is after the Battle of Armageddon, when Christ defeats his enemies that all resisted him, he takes possession of the earth, and now he's the king. He's the undisputed king over this globe. Satan and the demons have been set aside now and put aside in darkness and chains so that there is a glorious, peaceful haven now for 1,000 years. And Jesus Christ is going to be ruling. What's he going to be teaching the people to do? Keep the law. Because the laws found in the Ten Commandments are going to be the new constitution. The new constitution of the world government is going to be those same Ten Commandments. And it's going to include respect for the weekly Sabbath and the annual holy days. And here's proof of it. Shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem, and that means the ones that weren't killed, and there's going to be millions and millions that are going to be killed, but the ones that are left, which came against Jerusalem because they tried to fight him right there, shall even go up from year to worship the King, the Eternal of Hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So I remember being taught from the time I was a child, you think the annual holy days of Leviticus 23 were done away? They were commanded before, they were kept by the New Testament church in the first century, and they're going to be kept again. The Feast of Tabernacles is going to be kept by all peoples and all nations during the millennial reign of Jesus Christ to come, and yet somehow they're done away right now for you and me? Come on. You know, spout that if you want. Lie to yourself if you want an excuse for doing what you want and avoiding the obligation of preparing for and, you know, sacrificing in order to come to a designated place for whatever reason, either because you're afraid to travel or you don't have the money or blah, blah, blah. Tell yourself any lie you want to. But you're not going to convince God, who is the one who made these commands and requires it. If you love him, you're going to keep the commandments, and it includes showing up at appointed times during the year to worship him. Oh, yeah, it is a command. Shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of Hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whoso will not come up, how serious do you think Jesus Christ is going to be about this feast-keeping command? So as we hear all kind of, I really would like to go to the feast. I hope I can go one day. What is Jesus going to say to those who can't figure out a way to go to the feast? It shall be that whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth. Oh, not just Israelites, all the families of the earth. Who does this apply to? Everyone. And what happens to the ones who can't find a way to go to the feast? That whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Eternal of Hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. There are going to be curses, cause and effect for failing to keep the feast. No rain. This is during the millennium, by the way. The perfect paradise on earth. I thought there's not supposed to be any curses. This says there's going to be curses during the millennium. How and why? Upon those who refuse to respect their king. Upon them shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not that have no rain, meaning, okay, they blew it 1 year and they paid the penalty by not having rain. The families all around them had blessed crops, because they obeyed, but this family, they had something more important to do. They didn't get rain. They had a dismal harvest, which was their source of income, by the way, because it is going to be an agrarian society. So that's the limit. God's not going to strike them with a lightning bolt, but they won't get rain. So he'll get their attention. But what happens if they do it again the next year? They don't learn their lesson. If the family of Egypt go not up and come not, that have no rain, so the next year, there shall be the plague. Now, I don't know what kind of plague this is going to be, but it's a millennial plague. That sounds contradictory. I'm reading it right here out of Zechariah 14. God said this is going to happen. There's going to be a millennial plague, wherewith the Eternal will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Who's going to be called a heathen? Because all nations are going to be blessed under the rule of Jesus Christ. They're all going to be given an opportunity to worship God and to become spiritual Israelites. But physically, of every nation, who is it, whether a physical Israelite or one of the other nations, who's going to be under this plague? Anybody who refuses to show respect and to show up and appear before God during the Feast of Tabernacles. The Eternal will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt. And it's not just talking about physical born Egyptians, because the Egyptians, in other texts, and we'll read it later, are going to have a chance to be counted as beloved, just like Israelites physically. But spiritually, who's an Egyptian? A rebel against the instructions of God. Which means a physical Israelite who refuses to go to the feast, God is going to count as an Egyptian. Spiritually, those who will not take his instruction because they know better. They have a different set of priorities. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So it's going to be kept when Christ is the king over this earth. Does it really make sense that it's disbanded right now? Israel of old was commanded to respect it and to keep it. The Apostle Paul confirmed the New Testament church in the first century was keeping the feast still. It's going to be kept when Christ is reigning on this earth, but we don't have to do it today. Come on. God's true church has never been a popular trend. You know, and I didn't read you the text where God says that those Sabbaths are the sign between him and his people. But it is, it was before, and it is today. But God's true church has never been a popular trend. It was prophesied to be small and persecuted, even until the second coming of Jesus Christ. And that church, wherever you find it, the legitimate remnant of the true church of God, is going to be keeping the commandments, these Sabbaths and these holy days especially, as a fulfillment of that sign between God and his people. Last text, Revelation 12, 17, very quickly. Revelation 12, verse 17, here's a part of the prophecy leading up to that second coming of Christ. The dragon was wroth with the woman, that's the church, the true church, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed. Who are these that are part of a remnant of this church, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ? Why do they have the testimony? Because Christ revealed it, and they preserved it and refused to change it or pervert it with their own ideas. They are holding on to it as good stewards, including every aspect that was taught as a part of the commands for true Christians, including respect for Sabbaths and holy days. And it'll continue to the end of man's time on this earth. So what's the first, most obvious reason that we're here to keep the feast? Because God said so.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Because God Said So, the first message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Why Keep the Feast? Given on opening night of the Feast of Tabernacles in Yahats, Oregon, October 16th, 2024.